Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to Changing Politics. This is the podcast where we talk about the week's news, as well as finding something you can do to change the way the world is. I'm Marie LeConte.
And I'm Gráinne Maguire. If you've listened to the first two episodes, firstly, thank you. But also, you'll have heard about Cheney's Law, a private member's bill that will prevent the deaths of people in police custody. Well, we have news about that.
Yes, the bill passed its third reading in Parliament, meaning that it now goes to the Lords and will be back in the autumn to be hopefully made into law. So thank you if you're one of the hundreds of people who email their MP asking them to turn up and prevent it being filibustered.
You can see the video of the bill passing on our Twitter feed at Changing Polypod. And seeing as we're talking social media, why not like our Facebook page? facebook.com/changingpol.
Also, please subscribe to this podcast, as well as rating and reviewing it if you feel like it, because that helps other people find out about the show.
This week, we'll be talking about what you can do to help refugees, with the help of Lord Alf Dubs and a Syrian refugee. But first, let's talk about the week's news. Marie, it's been a bit of a quiet week, hasn't it?
I know, just boring. I just slept through it, to be honest. Like, do you know what happened? Or
I think there was a bit of drama, a bit of drums. A lot of messy bitches.
Oh, God, yeah, no, those resignations. I mean, I kind of enjoy the way it went from kind of, you know, shock, horror, David Davis. And then, you know, kind of like the next day, oh, my God, Boris Johnson. And then, whoa, Ben Bradley resigning as vice chair of the Conservative Party. And then PPS is resigning as well from their very, very minor roles in government. People you had never heard of who decided to take a stand, write a letter to the Prime Minister and then tweet that letter to just, you know, really stick it to the Remainers, I guess.
So, of course, this has been the news that after what seemed like Theresa May's halcyon triumph in Chequers, where everybody had agreed on this plan of what Britain were going to want from Brexit, it lasted a day and a half. Then David Davis resigned, then Boris, and then it seemed like the whole cabinet collapsed like a hastily made bit of crap from IKEA.
Well, the thing is, I wonder, and I'm not sure, obviously, you know, I've got a very good track record of being wrong about predictions, like, you know, over like the past few years, but I wonder if they've not kind of shot themselves in the foot, like the kind of hard Brexit is, because actually, David Davis and Boris Johnson were really not helpful in government. And actually, I mean, we're not sure what to expect from Dominic Raab yet as DEXU secretary, and we don't know what to expect about Jeremy Hunt at the FCO. But we do know that, for example, you know, Jeremy Hunt has always been quite a loyal Secretary of State. So, you know, he will not bluster and, like, you know, just do whatever he wants to do, like Boris. So I wonder if it might not actually have been cleverer for them to stay and kind of argue for their case inside the cabinet.
Yeah, you said they've been a bit lackluster. So David Davis has spent 4 hours in total negotiating in Brussels this year. To put in context, I have spent 4 hours updating my Ed Miliband Harry Potter fan fiction Tumblr blog. And I'm not getting paid for that. And that's not changing the course of British politics, though it should. So what has he been up to?
I'm not entirely sure, because I feel like, you know, we've known for quite a long time now that, you know, Number 10 and top Mandarin Ollie Robbins have mostly been in charge of the negotiations. So generally, it has been quite unclear what David Davis really has been up to all this time.
Now, Boris Johnson famously, before he decided he was going to go for Brexit, wrote a letter arguing. So one letter for Brexit and one letter for Remain. Do you think this is why he's done so little as a foreign secretary? For every decision he makes, he has to write a letter why it's good and he has to write a letter why it's bad. So he had to write a letter why it would be good to get a British-Iranian schism extra time in prison, and then he had to write a letter why he thought maybe that wouldn't be such a good idea. And this is what's been, you know, slowing his flow as a foreign secretary.
Well, I think that, okay, there's two things about Boris. Like, the first one is actually, like, he generally is very indecisive. And I think that, you know, when he wrote those two letters, obviously it was partly, I guess he was genuinely quite torn. And that's something I've heard from people who've worked with him at City Hall, and even in journalism on Whitehall. He is apparently sort of, like, chronically indecisive. So I think, you know, that probably can't help. But also, I think that, I'm not sure he ever was going to enjoy being a cabinet minister, if that makes sense. I think he wanted to become one, and the same way that, you know, he still probably, presumably, wants to become prime minister. But I think that's more kind of like ambition, a kind of like sense of restless competition that he has, as opposed to going, you know, I want that job because I think I'd be good at it.
That for me is like ultimate male privilege, being like, oh, bless his heart, he's just rubbish at making decisions. You have to like give him the benefit of the doubt. Bless his heart, he's just really indecisive, but he'll still be an amazing prime minister. He's just really flaky and hard, doesn't know his own mind. That's just Boris.
And I completely, and I think, you know, it's a massive class thing as well, because you get, again, you know, that kind of group of people, overwhelming men around politics, who, it's kind of a game, isn't it? You know, everything's a game, everything's fun, and actually, you know, because like nothing will have real life consequences for them. Like Cameron and Boris was like a good example, because they'd known each other for a long time, never really liked each other. So this kind of, you know, like, I won against you this round, and you know, you might win against me that round, whatever. So it's all, again, yeah, it feels like a parlour game.
So do you think Brexit could have been avoided if David Cameron and Boris Johnson had like just gotten better at secondary school?
I mean, maybe. Honestly, who can tell?
I just feel sorry. Like, imagine being Boris Johnson's conscience. Do you remember Pinocchio? He had, like, Jiminy Cricket going, don't do it, don't do it. But I think the difference with Boris Johnson is Pinocchio, whenever he lied, his nose grew.
And I don't want to know where that sentence is.
Boris Johnson gets a boner. There you go. You're a bit of an expert on the Johnsons, aren't you?
Again, did not know where that sentence was going. I am. I did write a very long piece about the Johnsons earlier this year, which was quite fun, though it took so long. I, by the end, kind of felt like, you know, when you kind of like binge watch something on Netflix, like, you know, for several days on end, you don't really see anyone, you just do that. And then you kind of have that sense of shame afterwards because you feel like you know the cast members of that show better than you know yourself or your family. I kind of had that with the Johnson siblings. But, you know, and I think, you know, actually like researching all that was really revealing because, you know, you've got stuff like, so Stanley Johnson, who is obviously like Boris's dad. There's a quite fun story about him. I think when he was at school or at university, and there was this grand prize where you had to write this sort of like impossibly long essay about, a, you know, sort of like serious but niche topic. He discovered it the day before and was like, oh blimey, like, you know, I really want to win this. And she just stayed up all night, wrote it, and then won. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's kind of that culture of like winging it. And I think, so when was it, I want to say it was when Boris ran to be London mayor, but I can't fully remember. But so his dad wrote a column in The Spectator, because apparently if you're a posh English family, that is how you communicate with each other, as a side note. Effectively saying, well, you know, I saw Boris when he was a child, when he was at Eton, and he was meant to play one of the main characters in a Shakespeare play, in the school play, had not learned his lines. So he basically sort of like fluffed it and made something up and made everyone laugh. And Stanley was effectively like, look, if he can do this, surely he can just be in politics and he'll be great as well. And it's like, no. These are two very different things, like two extremely, literally could not be any more different. So, you know, there were, I think there's that, yeah, incredible sense of competition among the kind of like Johnson siblings as well. Mm. And Boris has spoken about that before, saying that, you know, I had a kind of wonderful sort of like, you know, very early childhood, and it was brilliant and beautiful, and all got ruined the second my sister Rachel was born, because I was no longer the centre of attention. And then obviously, so Leo and Joe followed. And there are so many stories, literally countless stories about kind of like sibling rivalry, including one of my favourite ones is when Rachel allegedly called Boris, so like a good few years ago now, and was like, oh God, Boris, did you hear the terrible news about Joe? And Boris was like, what? And he's like, he got a first at Oxford.
Oh my God. God.
So they are this really weird family, and I think their parents, or at least mostly their father, I don't think their mother really did to the same extent, but I kind of encouraged them to always, always be in sort of like incredible competition with each other from age like zero. And I feel like that kind of explains so much about the persona of Boris.
What's interesting about your story about the play, so what happened was Boris didn't prepare, put the whole play in jeopardy, nearly sabotaged it for all his friends, and through sort of arrogance kind of winged it. And he was like, so that means he'd be an amazing politician.
Yep, literally, yeah.
It's like, what is it? Abraham Lincoln, he had sort of a cabinet of rivals to help survive the American Civil War. So that seems to be the same attitude the Johnsons have to rearing children. Trust no one. What did you think of that picture? What do you think of Boris's, that he posed?
Oh, God.
Like, what filter do you think he put on that?
I love that the pictures are actually quite expensive. So I think they were 150, 200 a pop. And I used to work on a picture desk, and I can tell you that's actually quite a lot of money. Like, normally it's about, like, 50, 100. But again, yeah, that is the Boris thing, where, you know, everything has to be an event, everything has to be drama. And I think his letter to the Prime Minister was quite revealing as well, because it was, like, romantic, nearly, sort of, like, view of life, where everything needs to have a narrative, and everything needs a sort of, like, heroes and villains and adventures. But that's not, you know, that's partly what politics is, but that's not what most of politics is.
That's a Just William story. Did you see the alternative picture he nearly used?
I did not.
That was just him shitting in Theresa May's desk, but they decided not to go with that one.
Speaking of Theresa May.
Oh, speaking of Theresa May.
Have you seen that the Daily Telegraph has gone mad?
Oh, what? Voice of the people, the Telegraph, surely not.
Well, yes, the Telegraph readers have accused Theresa May of treason, which, you know, in fairness, the people who write to newspapers are always a bit mad, so fine. But it's about the Telegraph has decided to fully embrace that and has now, you know, published it and kind of, like, you know, splashed quite big on that. So yeah, everything is going extremely well in the British media.
I love, like, the average age of a Telegraph reader must be so old. You could, like, were they the people who got Anne Boleyn locked up? Like,
they're actually, so I, my first job in journalism was at the Telegraph a few years ago, and there was a kind of dark joke we had in the office with a few friends of going, each one of those is a Telegraph subscriber dying. Because, you know, because they were so old, because we knew that, you know, I can't remember what the median age was, but it was bonkers.
What I thought was so funny about that was the Telegraph had like a letters page, looking at all these people writing us letters. It's like, the only people who write letters now are people who are writing their will.
I got, that's one of my, that reminds me of, it's so bleak, but I love the fact that Conservative Party correspondents with their members, they'll send at the bottom, they'll normally be something being like, hey, don't forget about us in your will. So you know your audience, and I respect that.
So there were other reshuffles off the back of Boris and David's messy bitchness. Jeremy Hunt has become Foreign Secretary, which means in 12 months' time he'll be trying to surreptitiously privatise France, or claim that more people die if they visit foreign countries on the weekend. How do you feel about his promotion?
I am intensely neither here nor there about Jeremy Hunt at the FCO. Like, I've tried to come up with an opinion. Like, you know, it's been several days now, and I've tried really hard to come up with an opinion, and I have none. I think it was quite a good move for him, because he really was, you know, the longest serving health secretary in, you know, in the history of British politics, and is actually still liked in the party. So I think, you know, that was quite a good thing for him to kind of, you know, occupy, like, get to the one of the great offices of state. But yeah, no, I mean, Matt Hancock at health, I'm not entirely convinced. I feel like DCMS really made sense for him, because he clearly loved it. He is passionate about digital. He's kind of passionate about art. And, you know, I think, what was it, like, he renamed himself the Secretary of State for the things that make life worth living, which is adorable and really dorky. And meanwhile, Jeremy Wright, you know, is not, like, what a weird choice, because he effectively, you know, has not tweeted, I think, since 2015. I think his only interest connected to the DCMS brief, as far as we can tell, is that he plays cricket so badly, I quote, that no one wants to play with me. Oh. And he used to play the trombone or the trumpet, and that's that. So that was a bit of a weird, weird move. So I don't know. And also is the fact that, you know, it was just white men. Mm-hmm. And when Downing Street was asked about that, they said, well, you know, Theresa, like the Prime Minister, just wants, what was it, like the right people for the right jobs or something along those lines. And it's like,
Just white men are just better at things. I think that's the lesson we've learned. I was really upset that Matt Hancock has become the health secretary because I have just deleted my Matt Hancock app. So I don't know how I'm going to get a doctor's appointment now. So Boris is gone. He's lying low, but he will come back. He's like the shark in Jaws. Do you think he's
cancer?
He's gone into remission, but he could be back. Mm. What are his plans now? Do you think he'll get a lot of support from backbench MPs? Is he popular?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, he never truly had that kind of base of support to start with. I think the reason why lots of Conservative MPs liked him for quite a long time was because he was the most popular politician in the country. And obviously, you know, if your goal is to win elections, then obviously you'd back the person who's the most likely to make you win that election. That being said, A, you know, his support is not what it used to be. But B, I think, you know, a lot of Conservative MPs are just really, really tired of his behaviour. Mm-hmm. And his kind of like lack of professionalism. And yeah, I mean, the way that, you know, over the past few weeks, like several of the things he did or said were just like genuinely openly mocked on Twitter by Tory MPs. And even like, you know, I was talking to a Tory MP the other day who, you know, his reaction was basically like, well, you know, actually, the good thing is if my constituents, you know, kind of come to me and they're like, oh, well, you know, what do you make of the Chequers deal? I were a bit worried about it. So, well, actually, I can tell them, you know, the Chequers deal actually got us rid of Boris. So it can't be all bad. Say another like really fun news, you know, Donald Trump is coming to London and, you know, there's going to be a big protest tomorrow, obviously. So are you going to that?
It's so annoying because I'm actually away at a festival tomorrow. Like I'm the ultimate cliche of like, oh, politics, but oh, I've got a festival to go to. The whole thing I feel the most sorry for is the Queen. So the Queen has to have tea with Donald Trump tomorrow. And I just feel so sorry for her because she must have thought she'd never have to have tea with another fascist after her uncle died. And yet, here she is in that situation all over again. That's my favourite joke. Are you a fan of Trump?
Love him. Just fucking love him, mate.
Breath of fresh air. That's what I think.
Just says it like it is.
Well, he got on with your president, didn't he?
Let's not even talk about that, genuinely.
You gave him grooming and everything.
Oh, those images, like literally on my deathbed, I will just see Trump like flicking fake dandruff from Macron's shoulder. It will haunt my nightmares until the day I leave this mortal coil.
With your deep dive knowledge of the Johnsons, do you think Trump would fit in if we're going to have Keeping Up with the Johnsons? Do you think Trump would make a good every now and then character who could pop in? Would he fit in?
I'm not sure. I didn't think so. I mean, I think he'd probably be a Black China, really. So, you know, kind of unexpectedly turning up and, you know, and the Johnsons aren't really certain about it.
Causing drama.
Yeah.
Making his dollar. You're making me like him now. This is bad.
Yeah, so like, yeah, can I just apologise unreservedly to Black China? You did not deserve this.
Black China is actually a self-made, you know, person. So yes, she's that over Trump any day of the week.
I was going to say, and she's actually like Amber Rose's best mate, which is great, and nearly said she's Amber Rudd's best mate, which again is also a show I would watch, by the way, if anyone wants to commission that.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, the big topic we're tackling this week is immigration and the refugee crisis, and specifically the attitudes British people have towards people coming to the country.
Well, I have some stories about British people reacting negatively to immigrants, but they're specifically just about me.
Oh, what was your immigrant journey like?
Oh my God, it was just a classic. Imagine just Saoirse Ronan playing me. I arrived mid-noughties. I had to live in North Finchley for a while.
Christ.
I was sleeping on a couch. It was really, really brutal. Marie, what was yours like? How delayed was that Eurostar?
Oh God, actually weirdly not delayed, but yeah, no, I mean, so tough, you know, taking the train from my hometown to Paris, taking a cab across Paris from one station to the other, taking the Eurostar, and then actually taking another cab where the cab driver called me love. And yeah, no, awful that, you like, you know, go see several houses, end up in Swiss Cottage, which is in fact the single most boring bit in London. You know, I'm still recovering from that in many ways, you know, 9 years on.
But isn't that, obviously, there are loads of media tropes about refugees and immigrants. So if you believe everything you read in the tabloids, immigrants are to blame for rising house prices, NHS funding shortfalls, and the dumbing down of the BBC. So wow, us immigrants are busy people. Take a day off, guys.
This week we thought we'd tackle some of those tropes head on. We've got an interview with Hamada, a Syrian refugee who has come to the UK, and we're going to try to answer some of the media's biggest questions and accusations with the first-hand experiences of someone who's actually lived through it all. So, Gráinne, you're going to have to be our tabloid headline shelter, providing the angriest anti-immigrant and refugee viewpoints.
It's what I was born to do. And as we're actually recording this on July 12th, an Irish person screaming angry things is very on point. So, why do people want to leave Syria? Why don't they stay and fight?
This is the first question people ask about refugees. We talked to Lord Dubs, who has done a lot of work on refugees and was a refugee himself.
There are a number of reasons why people leave. It's fear of war, it's persecution, it's fear of torture and imprisonment. I was talking to a Syrian boy who'd seen his father killed in front of him in Aleppo. Pretty horrific stories. Threats from the Taliban to young men who'd fled westwards from Afghanistan. So a whole range of reasons. But mostly it's a combination of war, violence, threats and persecution.
It's too easy to get into Europe. We shouldn't give them an incentive.
People then realise how hard it is to get here. We spoke to Hamada, a Syrian refugee who arrived in the UK a month ago.
It takes like 3 weeks. You know, media sometimes they're talking about when refugee pass to, for example, Greece, pass to Europe. Some guys, they think it's like a tourism journey, but unfortunately it was like, I can't say it, a death journey, because some guys, they died in the sea, some guys died in the journey. So when I moved to Turkey and you ask how you can go, for example, to Greece, you see the smuggler and they take you in like in big truck. In big truck, they put like almost 200 person in one truck. It's like small truck, not that big. You have just to be stand up. They drive you like maybe, no, it's like, so when I was like 5 hours, you have to be standing. And it was horrible because there is no space to sit, even no standing, because there is kids, there is families. No one told me about this. If I know this, really, I'm not going to do it. But what happened, you have to do it. So then they put you in the small boat, and almost like 40, sometimes 50. Like, there is kids, there is families. So in that time, it was the weather wasn't fine because we waited almost 2 days because the weather was very bad. But we slept like 2 days there, no food. And I was amazed because it was very horrible, very hot. I didn't know about that. I thought it's like tourism trip. You take the boat and you will go. No, it's not like this. So we were like almost 45 when a mini boat worked with us and we are in the sea. They told us it takes like 1 hour. It takes more than that. And the first 1 hour, like the water came in the boat. You feel like, oh, I'm going to die soon. I'm going to die soon. Why? So what we did, we caught like half of a bottle of water and we tried to throw water out. You need to save your life. So we did it first time, then it was okay. Then after like 15 minutes, the same. A big wave came in and then we started guys throw. They have some guys, some people, they have some bags. So they throw the bags out because, you know, the bags it's going to be wet and you're going to be more heavy. So second time, again, water. We throw the water. Then the third time, water. Then you say, okay, maybe we aren't safe. We are close now. So after like another like 1 hour, the machine stopped and we stuck. We tried to call the like Turkish number like for emergency help us. They didn't answer. We tried to do the Greece one. They didn't answer. So one man, he used to work like a mechanic. So he tried with it like almost 15 minutes. Then it worked. So we landed in the Greece. And there we saw some amazing volunteers, really. They give us like some blanket, they give us some, like, when you saw this in your eyes, when you see some guys that look after you, sell you things, they are like, look like angels. Then you have to move to Macedonia. We take like ferry to Athens. From Athens, we talk to Macedonia. Macedonia, we feel we aren't welcome there because they look at, oh, we are a stranger. Some, even in our journey, some guys, they think, oh, we are like tourism. They ask you for money, but for example, you don't have money. So we try to move quickly as soon as possible. So we moved to Serbia, the same situation. If you need to go from Serbia to Croatia, you have even to pay more money. So from Croatia, we moved to Slovenia. So from Slovenia, we moved to Austria. To Austria was, okay, not bad situation. But my plan, just I want to go to like United Kingdom. So from Austria, we moved to Germany. Then we moved to France to Calais. Now from Calais until the UK, this is another challenge. It was very hard.
Why did they want to come here? They could just stay in Hungary and Austria.
This is technically true, but there are reasons why people might want to come to the UK. Here are Lord Dubs and Hamada.
What is it about the UK? Well, sometimes it's a historic thing that they've long thought about the UK as being the place, if they can find safety, they'd like to go to. Sometimes they've got more sense of the English language than they have of other languages. Sometimes it's because they have relatives who've made it to the UK. But I'm bound to say, because by the time they get to Calais, that they're UK bound if they can possibly do it. But talk to the people in the camps in Greece, the majority want to go to Germany. And I think Germany has now become much more of a target, partly because they know people in Germany because of the numbers Germany has taken, partly because they have a sense the Germans look after them well. But the UK still has this tremendous pull. I was at a place for child refugees in Belgium a few months ago, and a lot of them had set their sights on coming to the UK. So I think it's a combination of tradition, language, the sense that they have freedom here and that they know people here.
It was like a hope when I was almost in secondary school, when we used to study English. I remember when they told us about UK, about especially England, London, how is human rights there, how there is a Hyde Park, and there is like called a corner in the Hyde Park, and you can talk whatever you want, no one gonna blame you, and you will get like this freedom. I say, oh my God. So of course I wish I'm gonna get to England.
They got to the jungle. Why don't they just stay there?
Well, they can't because it's been destroyed, but Alf went to visit several refugee camps around Europe.
The first time when the jungle was there, quite a large area, there were perhaps 8,000 or 9,000 or more people living there, quite a few children, but mainly young men. And it was pretty depressing There were ramshackle sort of tents and things. In the middle of the jungle, there was a little shopping street, and they had on display tear gas canisters and rubber bullets. And I said, what were they for? Well, they said the then French government tried to clear part of the camp, and to clear the people out, they used tear gas and rubber bullets. Why did they do that? Well, because the National Front are quite strong in that part of France, and the French government wanted to demonstrate they could be tough. Well, it seems to me you don't beat the National Front by behaving like they would. And then the third time I went, the jungle had been totally cleared, people had been dispersed, but some had made their way back to the Channel Coast, and then just sleeping under trees. Now, in warm weather, sleeping under trees is tolerable but awful. In cold weather, it's very, very depressing indeed.
This isn't our problem.
Well, it's a big problem, and everyone needs to do their part.
Worldwide, there are probably over 30 million refugees, plus about over 30 million displaced persons. That's people who fled for safety to another part of their own country. So it's about 65 million altogether. I don't know quite what the latest figures are in Syria. I know there are about 3 million in Turkey, 1 million in Jordan, 1 million in Lebanon, that's 5 million, and probably about 1 million have worked their way to Europe.
If you see the exploitation and try imagine what's going to happen, for example, for kids, if they have in this situation, for example, in Greece, how many kids there are there and how many women, girls there. But just imagine what this word means. Like, I'm a young guy, and I used to see really, unfortunately, so many like exploitation. This would happen in one country. They told me, I can't help you to get a passport for this European country. I'm not going to name which country, but you have to marry me. Excuse me, I would like, if I'm going to marry in the future, I'm going to marry a girl. So he told me, in our country, the men can marry together. I say, yeah, but please. So this would happen for like men, young men. So what about these kids? What they can see in their journey, some girls, they stuck, really.
Okay, so what can we do?
Well, here's what Hamada said helped him.
The hard thing is to find accommodation in the beginning, because at the beginning, yeah, you came here, you will find accommodation, they give it to you, but after when you get the visa, in 28 days, they tell you, you have to leave your room. So yeah, this is a big thing to worry about, because if you have no friends, it's hard. Where do you go? In that time when I had this situation, I remember here in UK, even especially, there is a very good organization called Refugees at Home. If they see your situation, you need help, they try their best, and really they helped me to find, like, even in the beginning, you need to learn about language, to find job. So this, what they helped me, really, they did a very good job.
And Lord Doves has four things he wants you to do.
One is that they should approach their MP and ask them whether they will go on giving support to Section 67 of the Immigration Act. Some people call it the Doves Amendment, but the media have done that. I don't call it that, because the government put a cap on it at 480. And frankly, we believe local authorities are able to provide foster care support for more than that number. So point one is to ask them to keep Section 67 of the Immigration Act open, not allow the government to stop it. Secondly, we passed an amendment here recently that for children who have relatives here under the Dublin Treaty, we've passed an amendment to the Leaving the EU Bill to say the government must negotiate for us to continue to be part of the Dublin Treaty. So children who have relatives in one EU country can join those in another, and once we've left the EU, it should still be possible for those children who've got relatives here to come here as if we were in the EU under those provisions, okay? So that's the second ask. The third ask is that there is a limited scheme whereby Britain takes refugees under the Vulnerable Persons Scheme from camps in Lebanon, Jordan and Turkey. That scheme will come to an end in 2020. And people should ask their MPs to keep the Syrian Vulnerable Persons Scheme open, so that we can go on bringing people, a limited number of people, from the region. And fourthly, I'd like people to lobby their local councillors and their local authorities and ask them what they're doing to take refugees, to take both child refugees and to take refugee families.
So that's what you can do this week. If you can donate even a little bit of money to Refugees at Home, they will help refugees get on their feet. Their website is refugeesathome.com. refugeescape.org.
You can also donate phone credit to refugees in Calais through Phone Credit for Refugees at pc4r.org. Because imagine spending 3 weeks getting to Calais from Syria. How much would it mean to speak to your mum?
And it's so easy. Text CALA85 plus the amount you want to donate. For example, CALA85 #5270070.
And don't forget to contact your MP or local council, like Lord Dubs asked.
That's it from us. We'll be back with more ways you can help change things next week.
Bye.
Liberty's leave policy was tremendous. Having the ability to take 16 weeks off, fully paid to bond with my child, was an incredible experience.
At Liberty Mutual, you can find a career that supports you at every step, even baby steps. We offer up to 16 weeks parental leave for new moms and dads. And because not everyone's pathway to parenthood looks the same, we offer robust fertility, surrogacy, and adoption benefits too. Learn more at libertymutualcareers.com and pursue your tomorrow today.